The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a 2-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome to our second week of meeting authors shortlisted for the Guardian First Book Award. We'll be hearing what the griot tradition of African praise singing has to do with one of this year's most original fiction debuts, and we'll be discussing some of the great world literature that exists outside the narrow confines of the Western literary tradition. We'll also go deep into British culture with the Scottish painter-novelist Alistair Gray.
He was, and educated, and became, residing and remaining and intending, until on became in and again and later again. He still is and hopes and works and may, but is certain too one day.
More from the inimitable Alistair Gray later. With me here now in the studio is Nadifa Mohammed, whose Black Mamba Boy is one of three novels shortlisted for our first book award. Hi, Nadifa. It was particularly popular with our Edinburgh reading group. Alongside her and Margaret Busby, founder of publishers Alison and Busby, and another publisher turned magazine editor, Ella Olfrey, deputy editor of Granter. Hi, both of you.
Hi.
Nadifa, will you just begin by reading us a passage from Black Mamba Boy and just explaining exactly where it comes from in the book?
Of course. I'm going to be reading from the chapter entitled Djibouti, and it's where my father's journey starts, really, on his own. And he's intending to go all the way up to Eritrea. He's just left Somalia and he finds himself in Djibouti. No border or sign alerted Jarmut to the fact that he was in a new country. It was just a feeling of going under. The lorry moved along with its nose pointing down, down, until it straightened out in a plateau of hellish, bewildering heat. Djibouti was low down and hot. It looked even more barren and fearsome than Somaliland, and the few trees that dared exist held up their arms in defeat. Rocks cracked open in 50-degree heat. The earth was bleached white, and the few comforts that the Somali desert shyly held out, blossoming cacti, large matronly bushes. The air had a corruption to it, a mingled scent of sleaze, sweat and goat droppings. Jarmut could hear people talking in a strange language over the din of road drilling, and to his amazement, they drove past a knot of reddened European men in tight little shorts. Grown men in shorts so small that they nearly revealed what Allah had commanded be hidden. They stood, hands on hips, thick moustaches bristling under their boxy hats, ordering around a group of sweating Somali workers. Jarmut's neck craned back to look at these men as the lorry sped past, certain that it was his first glimpse of the dangerous, womanly men of sin he had heard about in Aden. Jarmut's hands gripped the planks of the crate as he watched the mysterious men retreat into the distance. A man with moss-green teeth waved him back down. Francis, Francis, settle down, they're just Frenchies. Country boy, haven't you been out of the wilderness before? His mocking, bloodshot eyes stayed on Jarmut as he sat down and self-consciously composed himself. A breeze blew into his face. The smell of sea salt and the warm wetness of the air gave him an impression of travelling through a town at the bottom of the sea. The lorry slowed down in traffic, and arms and legs grew out of the blankets around him, stretching and straightening. They had reached their destination. Their lorry sat sadly in the traffic. They climbed out of the back, passing a few coins to one of the many arms sticking out of the driver's cab, heads all fixed ahead, cheeks bulging with masticated qad. Jarmut wanted to faint. The heat from the vehicles pushed up the temperature by a few more unbearable degrees. Cars and lorries were strung in a neat chain while army vehicles tried to weave in and out of the queue, their horns blasting a path through. Muscled pink forearms waved directions at the uninterested crowd. Drivers had left their seats to gossip and share water, but now they jeered at the pompous legionnaires. Still only on the outskirts of Djibouti town, Jarmut could already feel its bustling energy. He approached the beginning of the traffic jam and saw its cause. European soldiers manned a checkpoint and were nearly taking apart the vehicles in search of smuggled goods. Ignoring the complaints and abuse of drivers, banana crates were jimmied open, Livestock were released from their pens. Sleeping travellers were searched. Amid all this commotion, Jama eased his way around the checkpoint, behind the backs of armed legionnaires. A wide boulevard opened up before him. Jama dawdled along, enjoying the novelty of paving slabs under his feet. In Hargeisa, the ground was made up of 100 different types of sand, but there was not one paving slab in the whole town. Here, palm trees grew by the side of the road, evenly paced out like guards. Buildings stood in the distance, with a style at odds to Somali or Edeni constructions. They were curvaceous and tall, and built to last much longer than the edifices of the British in Hargeisa. This town was conjured up from the fantasies of its conquerors, a home away from home, despite the anti-European climate. A provincial French town picked up and dropped into the hottest place on earth.
Thanks very much. Now, that gives a really good impression of the huge, rich variety of people that Jama encounters along his way in this novel. But I want to start by saying that, qualifying myself, because I described it as a novel, but when you were introducing that reading, you said My Father's Journey.
It's a hybrid work, really. It's a mixture of biography and fictional narrative. So it's based very, very closely on my father's real life, Jama's real life. But I can't say that I've not interfered with some parts of the story. He would argue with me in certain areas, but I think that there's the general curve and arc of the story comes exactly from his life, how he became a sailor, how he entered the UK. But then there are aspects of it that I felt that needed either to be condensed, or I felt there was something missing, and I've stepped in and added that something.
Mm-hmm. Ella, you've read this and enjoyed it very much, I think.
I loved it. I think what I really loved was the sense of a continent and the way that he moves through countries and there aren't any borders. Towards the end of the book, he gets that precious little book that makes him sort of a British subject. I think if I didn't know that it was sort of based on your father's story, I'd be saying, oh, no, that's not possible at all. Were you surprised by how he moved across the continent?
Definitely, and it took me a long time before I believed him. So there were such strange events that happened to him when he was arrested and put in jail with a tortoise. He claimed to have waded across the Red Sea. All of these things, that he survived a bombing during the Second World War that killed everyone else. He had so much luck and so much kind of adventure that I really found it hard to believe that he was telling me the truth. But he remembered all of the small details that kind of eventually convinced me.
And of course, not everybody did make it, and including
Absolutely
his
not.
Two friends. And that's one of the saddest aspects of the
book. So that's actually one of the places where I've stepped in and deviated from his real life. But so many, like I think I read in one of the books about Eritrea that 9,000 Somali Askaris and Eritrean Askaris died in the one battle my father was fighting in Keren. So I wanted to pick out just two of those 9,000 boys and follow them and give them a past. And I know that the Italians buried them in these unmarked graves. These were people of my father's generation that he might have known, that might have been his relatives, and you know, they're buried God knows where in a field in Eritrea.
Now, I mentioned at the beginning the griot tradition, which you mention in your introduction.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that and why you evoked that. How important is that and why is it important?
Well, I was inspired by Amadou Karuma's book, Waiting for the Wild Beasts to Vote, and that's narrated by a griot. And it blew me away. I thought it was the first story that I'd read that actually really was as African as possible. And
but what is griot?
A griot is a praise singer, a West African praise singer who is the society's historian, poet. He'll work for a particular noble family and, you know, honour their ancestors and their achievements.
So you're doing that for your father?
Exactly.
You're honouring his achievement?
Exactly. I think that no one's ever celebrated a small person like my father. He's a small person who's generally at the fringes of history. And he's had an incredible life and an incredible tale of survival. And that's what I wanted to celebrate.
Mm-hmm. I was struck by something you said on the first page, which is, I tell you this story because no one else will.
Mm-hmm. That was my absolute motivation for writing this book, because I knew no one else would write it. In all the researches I've done and in my degree, I've never actually touched on the history of someone like my father.
Has your father read it?
Yes.
And does he approve of it?
He does approve. He likes it. I think he still wants someone to write a completely straight biography of him. He's greedy, but he's happy with this. He's happy with this so far. She wants something similar for herself now.
Okay. Oh, you're going to have to do that, aren't you?
I'm doing that now.
Now, in a Q&A in this week's Saturday Review, you listed a really interesting range of influences, which is partly why I thought of bringing Ella and Margaret into this podcast. They included Amadou Karuma, who you've already mentioned, who's an Ivorian writer from the Ivory Coast, and he writes in French, is that right?
Absolutely.
And the Jamaican Claude Mackay, as well as people more familiar to us, like Toni Morrison, Arundhati Roy, and Dylan Thomas. And you say of Karuma that you admire his ability to combine African forms of storytelling with European. I just thought that's a really interesting starting point.
Yes, it was unlike anything I've read before. So he, in Waiting for the Wild Beast to Vote, he's following the rise to power of an African dictator. So someone who's quite an ambivalent character, he turns into this huge, almost supernatural character, and he brings in the brotherhoods of West Africa, the wrestling, all of these aspects of the culture that you never see anywhere else. And I wanted to do something similar with an East African focus.
Uh-huh. Now, I want to bring Margaret and Ella in now, because it struck me that all those writers fall outside what we would think of as the sort of Western literary canon. And for those of you listening who don't know what a canon means, it's the books or writers that are widely agreed to be the keystones of a literary culture. So, for example, one would have maybe Shakespeare, Jane Austen and Charles Dickens in the UK, or Faulkner, Bellow and Roth in the US. Margaret, you have spent a whole career challenging this canon, haven't you?
I wouldn't say a whole career, but I was actually educated in Britain. I went to school here, I went to university here. So I was brought up on that canon of Dickens and Shakespeare and Chaucer, and very fine it is too. But I had to find out about all sorts of other sorts of literature in my own time outside my formal education. In fact, I was struck by something that Toni Morrison once said when she explained that she writes the kind of books she wants to read. Mm-hmm. And Alice Walker also said, I write all the things I should have been able to read. And there's another writer, a Zimbabwean writer, Tsitsi Dangarembga, who said something similar. I looked for myself in the books that I read, but I didn't find me. So I think there is that feeling of being excluded from the canon if you are not actually traditionally from that part of the world. And certainly, Amadou Karuma, all his books have not been translated even. Oh, he's a fine writer. So there are many wonderful books out there, which may be in English, may not be. Claude Mackay, certainly.
Yes.
Toni Morrison's fame was very recent, and not long before she won the Nobel Prize. Somebody asked me, who should have known better, who's he? When I mentioned Toni Morrison.
Ellen, you're from a different generation. What are the voices that excite you today?
I think that my experience sort of is sort of the same as Nadifa and Margaret's, in that the canon, which is sort of the Western English language canon, is very much part of my background in education, with a whole layer of other writers on top of it, writers who sort of influenced me or, you know, wrote about my country. I love Lambudza Marachera, who is a Zimbabwean writer. And I think that there's something that sort of enriches your experience if you have Dickens and Shakespeare and everything else, but then you also have Toni Morrison on top of that, Lambudza Marachera, Yvonne Vera, and some of the writers that the others have mentioned as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've just come back from the Istanbul Festival.
Yes.
So that, presumably there's a whole another set of authors out there. What writers are setting that?
It was really exciting. I kept being asked by everyone I met, so who have you read? And it got really embarrassing, saying, well, I know Orhan Pamuk's work, and they'd all say yes, and they would then mention a lot of other writers who are read widely in Turkey. And what was really embarrassing is that they knew all the writers who I was reading now, but because of the lack of translation from Turkish into English, there was a writer called Mario Levy who everyone kept talking about, and I met him, and he was just, you know, the coolest man I've ever met, leather jacket, you know, diamond earrings in both ears, of a certain age. And I immediately longed to read him. He hasn't been translated into English yet. And part of the trip was this sort of trying to cure my own ignorance, trying to meet translators who could read for me and pass things on, and see if we can sort of, you know, start something going there. And I think that kind of international literary festival is really exciting because it does opened the door to us.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about this, actually, because there, some people criticise literary festivals for just exporting the same old around the world. But this isn't your experience at Istanbul.
Oh, not at all. And it was really exciting finding out all the conversations that happen unmediated by English. There was one reading I went to where there were only two of us who were English-speaking, so they didn't translate, and the conversation was in Russian and Turkish. That experience of being totally excluded because of language really sort of strengthened my resolve to, you know, try and find a way around it.
To learn Turkish, apart
from
it.
Well, I don't know, but, you know, to find a way to get more translation done.
So are we going to see a Granta based on Turkish writers, these writers you've discovered?
Well, of course, I'd love any excuse to go back to Istanbul.
Because you've got a Spanish language one just about to hit the stands.
Yes, our next issue that's out later this month is the Best of Young Spanish Language Novelists. And it's the first time Granta magazine has ever had a complete issue that's all in translation. And these are from Argentina, Peru, Bolivia, Uruguay, as well as Spain, who we think are going to be tomorrow's stars. Mm-hmm. And that's been really exciting, sort of finding these new voices and bringing them to our readers.
Yeah, we'll look forward to that. Now, I'm going to ask you all to throw yourself into a parlour game. We've talked a little bit about what we would like to see in the canon, but I would like us in this studio to come up with 10 canonical writers that represent our culture here at this moment. So we've got two. Are we going to accept Nadifa's suggestions as two of our canon?
Yes, I think
Karuma, definitely.
Absolutely.
And Marichera.
Yeah.
Yep.
Great.
Yeah. I think he won the Guardian Fiction Prize.
He did.
He won in 1979. I was there.
Really?
Well, is it true that he threw plates?
He certainly did. He was, it was as if he was sort of, you know how you skim stones across water? Was, you know, there was a buffet lined up and he decided to pick up plates and skim them.
Well, actually, China Mieville did a broadcast with us earlier this summer, and he picked him as one of his most influential writers. So I think his influence.
House of Hunger, I think, is a fantastic collection.
So we're putting House of Hunger on the list.
Yes.
What are we putting on from Karuma?
Can it be Waiting for the Wild Beast to Vote?
Waiting for the Wild Beast to Vote. Are we putting Claude Mackay on our list?
Yes, I mean, actually, talking about some Caribbean writers, talking about literary festivals, let me break some news here. There's going to be a new literary festival in Trinidad and the new big Caribbean Literature Prize launching in the spring. Just in the way that the Kane Prize for African Writing, I think, has revitalized the whole African writing scene, I think the same will happen for Caribbean literature, which I think has fallen a bit behind in recent years.
Yes, that's interesting, isn't it? What's happened to it? Why has it fallen
behind? I think the spotlight has shifted to Africa, it seems, in terms of, you know, foreign parts and India. But certainly it's time, I think. There are some fantastic Caribbean writers. I would like to suggest Earl Lovelace.
Earl Lovelace. Yes. Everybody, we've got a seconder for Earl Lovelace?
Yes, I do, yes.
And what are we going to put from
Salt? Is the one, that his last book, which won the Commonwealth Writers Prize. But, I mean, a book that he's also very well known for is The Dragon Can't Dance.
Number five.
You'll all have to forgive me, but I'm going to put someone in who may be contentious, but Octavia Butler.
Good.
I'm so glad you... I thought I was going to have to fight. But I think Octavia Butler tells us so much about America, and her novel Kindred is probably one of my favourite books. And I think that if her work was not classified as science fiction, we'd maybe read Kindred in the same way we read Beloved.
So she's a science fiction writer.
She is, but she investigates race and the nature of being American of any race and the interconnectedness of the slave owner and the enslaved. Well, she would definitely be right at the top of my canon.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to add something which isn't a novel.
Under
fine. Milkwood by
Dylan Thomas. Now that's really interesting.
I was introduced to it at A-level and it haunted me and it's completely beautiful and joyful and funny. And
shall I let you into a secret?
Yes.
Our producer, Tim Mabey, was in the very first stage production of Under Milkwood in Oxford, way back when. Very exciting. Now, I also think that that's a really good one to include because we're being generous here, aren't we? We're being very broad in our acceptance
I'm
of what a canon might be,
everything.
Which is
what
right
did he
and
leave
proper.
Out? I mean, is Salman Rushdie part of the canon or not?
It's up to you.
I think so.
I think he is.
Yeah. Yes. Midnight's Children. Yeah.
We think Midnight's Children. We've got three more, 8, 9, and 10.
Well, I don't know. Let's talk about this because I wanted to include Okhotun Batek because I love his Songs of Lewin and Songs of Akol because it's it speaks to what Nadifa was talking about earlier on about sort of a storytelling tradition. And this is, I guess, poetry, but sort of not not in the way that one would read it in the Western tradition. And I really love it. And I think I find it quite difficult to read because I feel like I'm learning a new language.
What is the entry? What is the entry for this?
Yeah,
what is
Black Jacobins.
Hang on, we've
Song of Lawina.
Song of Lawina.
Yes.
And it's poetry.
It's poetry.
And this is another point, actually, which is that we're also being generically generous, aren't we? Yeah. Which is, so we've got a verse play, yeah. We've got poetry, we've got novels, and I think that's a really good point. That's one up for us.
Well, we concur with the...
Nadifa and Margaret concur.
Yes. And Ella. And we Ella. All go for C.L.R. James. Yeah. Black Jacobins?
Yes.
Or Minty Alley, his only novel, is a possibility.
I think Black Jacobins, yes. Yes.
Okay. So we've got non-fiction in there,
yes,
as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay.
Our last one.
Last one, number 10. Yeah. Unless we boot Salman Rushdie out on the basis.
He's
already had it all already.
Actually, talking about Salman Rushdie, Salman Rushdie said about another Guardian Fiction Prize winner, Roy Heath... Guardian Fiction Prize 1978, I believe, with The Murderer, that he is a beautiful writer. And I agree, Roy Heath, The Murderer. You may not have read it, you should read it. From Guyana?
I haven't, but now I will.
we're going to put Roy Heath in. So that's technically 10, but you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to come in with the chairman's vote and I'm going to push Salman out. Not because I don't revere him, mm-hmm. but because I think it would be quite nice to get somebody, these are all classics, aren't they? Get somebody very recent. Where are we now? What's mm-hmm. the really buzzy person we want to include?
I love Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and I know that she's really widely read, but I think that her last book, Offer for Yellow Sun, taught me a lot about how you can make something that's sort of very intimate and domestic mean the whole world. She writes about Biafra in a way that it actually, for the first time, I felt that I knew what it meant, and I knew what the cost was to people. Mm. And I think we'll be reading her for a very long time, and she's just wonderful. Mm.
I agree, actually. I grew up in northern Nigeria, and I found it really shocking what... I just thought this is the bit of history that I was never told, because I was being fed propaganda like everybody else was.
But she makes it meaningful for all of us wherever we are, and I think that that's, and not sacrificing her story or her characters at all. It's pretty special.
I don't know anyone who's read it who hasn't been moved by
Yes.
Well, that's very good. Are we settled? Are we agreed? We don't have any fallings out over this canon we've just invented.
Yes, and I'm really pleased there's someone I hadn't read on that list, so I can...
There are a couple I haven't read, actually, so I'm going to have to get busy. Nadifa Mohammed, Ella Alfrey and Margaret Busby, thank you very much for coming in. And on the podcast page, we will have a space for you to put in your own suggested canons, because some of you will probably disagree with us. And now to another author of multiple influences, one of those rare talents who is just as well known for his painting as his writing. He is Alistair Gray, and many of you will have seen his fabulous pictures in last week's Saturday Review. They come from his new book, A Life in Pictures, which, as ever with this great maverick, defies easy description. Is it an art catalogue? Is it an autobiography? Richard Lee dragged him into the studios to explain himself.
I belong to Glasgow, dear old Glasgow town, but there's something the matter with Glasgow, for it's going round and round. I'm only a common old working lad, as anyone can see, but when I get a couple of drinks on a Saturday, Glasgow belongs to me.
You're very insistent that A Life in Pictures is not an autobiography. Why not? What would it take to turn it into one?
Oh, I should tell lots of fascinating anecdotes about my sex life. In the first place, it was conceived as a book that would show as many of my pictures as possible. As somebody who has been a pictorial artist for a very long time, when I was young, I hoped that eventually, when I become famous as an artist... Herbert Reed, yes, he should write the editorial introduction to the book of my great paintings, and later, no, Kenneth Clark, he'll do, just the man. And later, no, John Berger, he's a real socialist and a far better writer. And he's still alive, I'm glad to say. But eventually, my pictorial art only became well known because I illustrated and designed my own books. And it was only 2.5 years ago when I got an art dealer, Saoirse Dallas, a Glasgow art dealer. I'd grown up when there weren't any international art dealers in Glasgow. There had been a lot, but they died out after the 1418 war. I never thought they'd come back. But Saoirse Dallas took up my art and persuaded some people in London that I was worth looking at, or my pictorial art was worth looking at. And therefore, though I've put in all the pictures I could find and fit in and arranged them chronologically, I've filled the spaces between the words with some explanations of how these portraits of this mural came to be painted at that time.
Do you think this will serve as a kind of autobiography for you, or have you another book in the works?
Not in the works. I've thought if I did write an autobiography, I would call it Life Sections, because it would be a chapter about the drink, my alcoholism. Limited, I may explain. I don't fall down nowadays, nor use inappropriate language or gestures. The women in my life, there have been very few of them. My present wife, we've been together 20 years, and we'll see each other out or off.
But it's not that you have anything against autobiography as an idea, as a concept, as a mode.
Edwin Gosse's book, Father and Son, is one of the best autobiographies in the language, or one of the best written books in the language, but it's more interesting about his father than he is about himself, though in fact the relationship between them is a very interesting one. No, nothing against autobiography.
I was wondering if one of the things that led you to write a book like this, to assemble the pictures together and tell a story through those pictures, was because your life, in some sense, defies summary. There's new starts, new directions.
I think everybody's life refuses summary. I once wrote an autobiographical poem. No, a biographical poem, which went, "He was, and educated, and became, residing, and remaining, and intending, until on became in, and again, and later again. He still is, and hopes, and works, and may, but is certain to one day." But I wrote also a short poem which called Autobiography, which is, "I am newborn. I want to suck sweet and sing, and run and laugh and fuck and feel secure, and own my own home, and receive the education due to a man in..." "Receive something due to the man in my position, and not have nobody to care for me, and not to be lonely and die."
So it's done already. The autobiography is there.
Yes. And any man's autobiography.
Do you draw any kind of a distinction between your pictorial art and your written art, those two sides of your artistic character?
Yes, they're done with different tools entirely. I keep quoting a German philosopher, and I forget whether it was Schelling, who said that sculpture and painting operate through the dimension of space, music and literature move through the dimension of time, which is in some ways true, but not completely, because you can't see... There's no picture that you can see in a single moment. In order to enjoy it, your eye travels over it and explores it from one moment to another, may synthesize it finally. And of course, it's a very big painting, like a mural. You have to take it in with umpteen glances over quite a long time. Both music and poems and novels can evoke a strong sense of space, can convey a landscape, can even give you the notion of somebody's face. It is operating spatially as well by its appeal to the imagination.
The two are definitely in parallel all the way through.
Well, one is always a tremendous holiday from the other. I think, healthier painting than writing, because as every journalist and writer knows, when you've been writing a lot and your head's been full of words, you are still muscularly not exhausted, but you're nervously exhausted. So in order to sleep, you go out and drink heavily, unless you're better disciplined than I am. And on the other hand, if I have been painting, particularly if it's a mural work that requires standing up and climbing scaffolding, after quite a lot of that, I can go to bed after just one small whiskey and, well, one large whiskey, and fall asleep easily.
There's much of your fiction, and there's a strong strand of playing games with the position of the writer in the text, his relationship to it, of placing frames around the fictions that you're creating. But many of the pictures in this book seem much more straightforward. Why is that?
I don't know. Because I'm a more straightforward person when I'm painting than I am when I'm telling stories.
I'm wondering that if it might be because it's more natural to you in some sense to make a picture, whereas the act of writing a fiction needs some justification, some scaffolding around it.
If you say it's natural, that is true in that I was given, my parents gave me crayons and paper to draw, and therefore I was drawing and scribbling before I learned to write and read. I earlier on certainly tried to draw attention or entertain people, initially my sister, by telling long and elaborate stories. When we were walking to school together or late at night, we slept in adjacent bedrooms, and I would tell her this long involved serial story as long as she stayed awake. And next time when she asked me to continue the story, I would say, "When did I stop?" And of course she wouldn't remember the point in which I had stopped because she would have fallen asleep during it. "I'm not going to tell you a story if that's your attitude." and so she would beg and plead me to continue the story, so I would condescend and do so. But in fact, I would have been much more unhappy than she if she hadn't wanted me to go on with the thing.
So they were always part of your life, both strands were part of your...
I think so.
Yeah. There's also a refreshing directness about money in the book. How do you think your career might have been changed if you had come by a stack of money early in your career?
I think I would have been painted much more than I did. I couldn't sell my paintings very much. I had hardly any commissions. My earliest murals were painted for people who... The Scottish USSR Friendship Society, when I was a student, Greenhead Church of Scotland, they couldn't pay me money to do it. They could just pay my painting materials. I hoped these would make me famous and well-known so that I'd get commissions. They never did. My commission paintings happened later in life through a few individuals, Elspeth King, former curator of the Glasgow Local History Museum, who, when creating a new local art gallery in Dunfermline, commissioned me to paint the ceiling of the long gallery there, and then Colin Beattie, who acquired the Oran Mór, a former very big church, and has paid me steadily to muralise the auditorium, and has paid my assistants to help me too, and I've not finished that job. I will one day, but at present I've got my first major commission, public commission, to design a mural in tile and mosaic for the vestibule of a Hillhead Underground station, which is conveniently near my home.
It seems perhaps a little indelicate, but I mean, with a youngster like Martin Amis worrying about death approaching and whether he's got time to get through all he needs to, do you worry about that ultimate deadline yourself?
No, I don't think I do. I'm only afraid of pain. I think I'll have enough health care to approach death in a state of euphoric idiocy. I've been very lucky because when I was much younger, I thought, there's one novel in me, Lanark. When that's finished, I can die happily. It came out, and, I was quite sure it would become a famous book that the world would not willingly let die. But, in fact, it was amazingly successful. William Boyd reviewed it, and a page or two of the Times Literary Supplement the week it came out. And everybody in London liked it. So, of course, people in Scotland thought, I must be a good writer. After that, everything... For instance, I meant to write one book of short stories, but there was one story I'd been meaning to write for years, a very, very short one. In trying to finish it for this book, it suddenly swole up and became bigger and bigger and turned into what I think is my best novel, 1982, Janine. And I thought, "Oh, I never knew you had so many books in you, Grey," said I to myself, said I. And I've been sometimes rather surprised by my productiveness. One can see, but when I get a couple of drinks on a Saturday,
Glasgow belongs to me. The splendid 75-year-old Alistair Gray still leading us all a merry dance and talking there to Richard Lee. Since we're talking influences, he includes painters and musicians, psychologists and anthropologists among his. And he in turn has been cited as an influence on people as diverse as the poet Liz Lockheed, the novelist Irvin Welsh, the Scottish rock band Idlewild, and the sculptor and photographer David Shrigley, all of whom turned out this week to pay tribute to the master in Glasgow. If you come to this podcast via iTunes, you can find a gallery of Alistair Gray's work on guardian.co.uk/books, and you really do have to see it to appreciate just how brilliant he is. And that's it for this week's podcast. In the Guardian Review on Saturday, Booker Laureate Anne Enright asks why the Irish are so good at the short story. And we have a profile of another canonical writer, the South African Nobel Laureate Nadine Gordimer. Meanwhile, on Sunday, the Observer's new review will reveal the winner of the Observer Jonathan Cape Graphic Short Story Award. And lastly, if you haven't yet entered our first book prize competition and put yourself in with a chance to win a set of all the shortlisted books plus two tickets to our awards party, you have until November the 9th to do so. That's Tuesday. There's a link to it on the front page of this podcast at guardian.co.uk/books. We'll be back next week with another of our shortlistees, plus an interview with the New Zealand author Lloyd Jones, whose latest novel, Hand Me Down World, has been the subject of our very first Guardian Twitter book chat. You can find that on hashtag HMDWChat. If you're a Twitter frequenter, you'll know what that means. It took me ages to find the hashtag on my Apple keyboard. I've now found it, and I can tell you in confidence it's Alt-3. Anyway, until next week, thanks for listening. I'm Claire Armistead and my producer is Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.